You're listening to Midori Howe's first broadcast on the 17th of December 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
Today, the United States of America is changing its relationship with the people of Cuba. In the most significant changes in our policy in more than 50 years, we will end an outdated approach that for decades has failed to advance our interests, and instead, we will begin to normalize relations between our two countries.
The most dramatic foreign policy maneuver of Barack Obama's presidency, an end to America's half-century and change diplomatic and economic blockade of Cuba. I'll be joined by Jeffrey Kaufman and Michael Binion to discuss that and the day's other top stories from Peshawar and Moscow. We'll also be talking about the current state of Australia's movie business.
You can't get rid of the Pepper Dog.
You can bring me the boy. You can bring me the boy.
Our tech correspondent, David Phelan, will review the new BlackBerry.
It's called the BlackBerry Classic, and if you've ever used a BlackBerry Bold, it's immediately familiar. They've said they want to style it to look like that because that's been such a successful phone for them.
And we'll raise the curtain on the latest theatre openings with Matt Wolfe and check in with our woman in Brussels. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. But ahead of all that, the latest world news with Jonathan Wheatley.
Thousands gathered today in Pakistan's largest city, Karachi, and held a candlelit vigil for the children and teachers killed in Tuesday's school attack in Peshawar. The Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif has lifted a moratorium on the death penalty a day after Taliban gunmen attacked a school, killing 132 students and 9 teachers. 3 days of national mourning are now being held as people in Peshawar try to come to terms with what happened. The Taliban said the attack was in response to government military operations against it. Well, the Pakistani military spokesman is Major General Asim Salim Bajwa.
We heard that there was a teacher who tried to stop them from killing students, and that teacher was then burnt right on the stage. I am a military man. I have seen a lot of action in life, but then I am a human being. I have the same feelings as you. We are all sad. We are all angered. We are all sickened. I think there is nothing that could happen worse than this.
More than 230 bodies of people believed to have been killed by Islamic State militants have been found in a mass grave in Syria's eastern Deir al-Zor province, a group monitoring the country's war said on Wednesday. The bodies were believed to be members of the Al-Shitat tribe, which has battled Islamic State militants, the British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said. The president of Sierra Leone has announced a ban on parties and other festivities over Christmas and New Year holidays as the country tries to halt the spread of the Ebola virus. More than half of the West African cases reported since the latest outbreak began have been in the country. Ernest Baikoroma addressed the country, setting up plans to start house-to-house searches for hidden Ebola patients.
I have given my approval to the National Ebola Response Center to embark on a special operation in the western area to control the current rates of infection and stop the spread of the disease in the region. This intervention is called Operation Western Area Surge.
The sister of the accused Boston Marathon bombers appeared in a New York City courtroom on Wednesday. Alina Sanayev is accused of making a threatening phone call to a woman, telling her she could put a bomb where you live. Sanayev, sister of Jokhar and Tamerlan Sanayev, was arraigned on 2 counts of aggravated harassment in the second degree back in September. She was later released on $5,000 bail under condition that she have no contact with the alleged victim. If she's convicted, she faces a maximum penalty of up to a year in jail. And the Palestinian leadership on Wednesday prepared to present a draft resolution with the help of Jordan to the 15-member UN Security Council calling for the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land to end by November 2016. The United States, which has a veto at the Security Council, has already indicated it finds the timeline in the Palestinian proposal unacceptable. The Palestinians need 9 of the 15 votes in the Security Council to pass the resolution, which would force the United States to decide whether or not to veto it. George Jacobman is a Palestinian political science expert.
The attempt, in other words, is to try to internationalize the Palestinian-Israeli conflict insofar as possible. The other aspect has to do with internal Palestinian public opinion, which puts a lot of pressure, is putting a lot of pressure on the Palestinian Authority to try to bring about some change in the status quo that Palestinians cannot bear for various reasons, because primarily occupation continues.
And that's the latest news here on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Op London, tu er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London, London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's 18:06 here in London, 13:06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on today's news, and there's plenty of it, here in the studio, journalist and commentator Jeffrey Kaufman and Michael Binion, foreign affairs writer and former diplomatic editor, easy for me to say, of The Times. Welcome both. We will start tonight with the dramatic thaw in the long-iced relationship between Washington, D.C. and Havana. Cuba has agreed to the release of Alan Gross, a U.S. citizen who spent 5 years in a Cuban prison on charges of espionage. In response, speaking within the last hour, President Barack Obama has announced an end to more than half a century of passive-aggressive hostility towards Cuba. A U.S. embassy is expected to open in Havana within months. President Raul Castro of Cuba has also confirmed this frankly long overdue normalizing of relations. Jeffrey Kaufman, you spent a great deal of time covering Cuba. Your response to today's quite startling developments.
Well, let me put it to you this way. You know, in all the years that I covered, I spent 10 years with ABC News in Miami covering the Caribbean, Cuba, Latin America. And in all of my years, I began to wonder whether I would live to see a thaw in relations. And you know, I'm not that old. I've got a bit of time left. But I'm stunned on one level because it's actually moved. There were so many times we thought it would. But you know, good on Obama. Good on Raul Castro. This is the most. It is the most ridiculous feud. That really, based on grudges, it's like those two old neighbors who won't talk. They can't quite remember what began it.
It is Hatfields and McCoys on a grand scale, isn't
completely.
It?
Completely. And this is epic. And Obama, when he spoke at noon Washington time today, talked about engagement. And I think, you know, there's just no question that isolation and embargoes for 60-plus years have accomplished zero. And I think that you're going to see engagement, meaning letting people travel back and forth, opening up lines of communication and trade, et cetera, bring down Castro much faster than any embargo sure didn't.
Well, Michael Binion, to bring you in, this was what I always thought about the embargo, for all that my opinion on these things is worth. Did it accomplish anything beyond keeping the Castros in power for decades past the point at which history, the collapse of communism, the end of the Cold War would have brought them down?
It accomplished absolutely nothing, really. The only thing was it gave Russia a so-called listening post in the Caribbean, which is not something the West particularly wanted. It gave right-wing Republicans a real good cause to rally around. I was a correspondent in Washington when Reagan came in, and he found Cuba an extremely useful pretext for a number of things. He pointed to Cuba.
The almost literal Reds under the bed.
It was, yes, that's right. He had them at the border of Texas. He thought that they were funding the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, and he saw the Cubans as really intent on keeping the evil empire alive in the Western Hemisphere. It accomplished nothing, frankly. It's the longest diplomatic sulk in history.
Barack Obama, in his address, did actually invoke the definition of insanity often attributed to Einstein. Einstein, that of doing the same thing repeatedly and expecting different results. Jeffrey, back home in the United States, you know, there is a common political saw which holds that there's no votes in foreign affairs, which obviously isn't Barack Obama's problem. But is there any domestic political mileage in this for him?
So this is an interesting point. When I first moved to Miami in 2001, I remember someone wiser than me saying to me, I had covered the Elian Gonzalez affair. You remember the little boy who appeared, who floated into Miami's waters and became a huge international tug of war in 1999. And I remember that I was with CBS Evening News in New York then. And I remember saying, this town is crazy. I will never, ever live here. And a year and a half later, ABC made me an offer I couldn't refuse. And I spent 10 years in Miami. And one of the first things I learned about Cuba was that don't think that Cuba's foreign policy in America. It is domestic policy. That you know, Florida is the fourth largest state, has close to 1 million Cuban Americans. And they, as the first of the big states to swing and vote in elections, they have held outsized political influence in America. It is really true that they've almost been kingmakers in the White House now for a couple of decades, and they've known it. And so their power, what's happened is the old, let me call them politely, dinosaurs, the old guys who just can't give up, the Hatfield-McCoy grudge, held on, but they've died. We've seen a generational change amongst the Cuban Americans. And finally, to answer your question, there's much less risk now for the Democrats as well as for Obama, because there are a lot of people who've just said, come on, this is ridiculous.
That said, Michael Binion, you spent a lot of time in Washington. It's said that when Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act, he sort of muttered that he just lost the South for the Democrats for a generation, presently, as it turned out. Has Obama just done the same for Miami and Florida?
Well, except that most Cuban Americans vote Republican. I mean, he's sort of lost them some time ago. They've drifted steadily further to the right over the decades. And I don't think it's a big political cost to him at all. I think he will pick up votes for, frankly, his only to date big foreign policy achievement, if that is, it comes off. I mean, two big ones that he might get in his presidency would be this and perhaps Iran. But it's not a done deal yet. I think it will be.
You know, let me just say something. You said in your introduction something that is factually correct, that they're going to open a U.S. embassy in Cuba. Big secret here? There is a U.S. embassy in Cuba. It's just not called that. And it's been there. Diplomatic relations with Cuba broke off in 1961. In 1977, Jimmy Carter opened reciprocal diplomatic relations as through what's called the U.S. and Cuban interests sections in Washington and Havana.
One of those convenient diplomatic hypocrisies. Yeah.
Part of the Swiss embassy, in fact.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
There is a huge U.S. embassy building on the Malecón, on the water, and there is the chief of the U.S. interest section, and it is, I'm not sure what the numbers are on the Russian embassy, but I think it might now be the biggest diplomatic mission in Havana today, not when Barack Obama sends an ambassador.
It's akin to those, in quote marks, trade delegations at various countries
maintain in Taiwan to avoid
upsetting Beijing. Yeah.
So you know, there has been this quiet agreement, particularly on drug trafficking, migration. When they feel like cooperating, they do.
You spend a lot of time in Cuba, Jeffrey. How are Cubans likely to react to this? Will there be unalloyed rejoicing? Will there be some who see it as a defeat for the revolution?
No, I don't think very many people will. I really don't. I think even the most loyal people in the army and in the Castro government recognize that this has just been going on for a crazy amount of time. I think it's one of those things you just don't quite know how to stop. My sense is, and I haven't seen any TV footage out of Havana. The Cubans are such a kind of Caribbean laconic group. I can't imagine that they're going to be. I mean, they do love to dance and party, so maybe they'll be dancing in the streets. But I think that they're so skeptical. I think that they're so burned by what authority tells them. I think it's going to be more of a wait and see. On verra.
We'll see a lot of false dawns already.
Yeah.
They've seen a lot of times when they thought something was going to come and it might, but it didn't. And they've also seen kind of promises of liberalization at home only to have that pulled away from them. I mean, there have been attempts to encourage small private enterprise, sort of tiny modest steps before, and then suddenly they clamped down again on it. So it's gone up and down.
The interesting thing about Cuba is that when you look at sort of the pantheon of 20th century dictators, you know, and you think of the horrible people who left such scars on this planet in the 20th century, you know, Hitler, Mussolini, you know, you can even go nearby to Papa Doc in Haiti, Duvalier. Castro was a bad man in many ways, and people did die in the early years of the revolution. But as time passed, he became a much more benign dictator, and his brother even more so. And so while you can hear people, some of the old men who are still alive in Havana railing against Castro, the reality is that there are many more oppressive regimes. And the strange dichotomy of Cuba is that while human rights really are limited, that there are certain parts of that regime, healthcare in particular, although feeble, still universal, education, there are certain things that many people in other Caribbean nations don't have. So it's a more complex thing than to say good and bad.
Michael, again, to return to your experience of Washington, Barack Obama, obviously, as has been noted left, right and center, is kind of running out the clock. He's got slightly less than 2 years still to go. He's got a Congress that hates him, a people who are tired of him. Does this revitalize his presidency? Does this now give him a certain amount of political capital to do other things domestically or overseas?
Well, a certain amount, yes. But I think this is not something that's very easily translatable into foreign policy generally across the board. I mean, it doesn't really have much carryover into Iran, say, and it doesn't really carry a lot of weight in Congress. Yes, those that wanted this in any case will applaud him for doing it. Those that are his enemies, and that's the majority in Congress, will either try to cut back the scope of this kind of deal, or they will try to make it difficult for him, or they will try to claim the credit for themselves, because after all, it is Congress in the end which will have to lift the embargo, not the president. So it does come back to them.
You know, it's interesting. I think it's going to be interesting to watch that, because there are so many Republicans who have been against the embargo and, you know, pro-trade, who want to sell rice and wheat and American apples into Cuba. You know, it'll be interesting to see whether ideology yet again divides Washington, or call me naive. Let's talk again in a couple of months. There is a remote possibility that even Republicans will support the lifting of the embargo.
Perhaps, but
enough,
some,
enough that
the
Congress can surpass
the diehards. It won't be overwhelming. The diehards will
be against
it.
You know, you get enough Democrats and Republicans, and they just might get that embargo lifted.
Oh, I think they will.
It'll be interesting to watch.
I think they will.
But he at least, you know, as you say, it is a foreign policy victory if he pulls this off. And he does get to become the president who ended the ridiculous embargo.
On that note, we will end this discussion of a momentous day for American diplomacy. We'll move on to other stories occurring. We'll look now at Pakistan, whose political and defense establishment will be confronting the always difficult question of how best to respond to an obvious provocation. Yesterday's assault by the Pakistani Taliban on the Army Public School in Peshawar left 132 students and 9 teachers dead, and a Pakistani public understandably frightened and justifiably furious. Michael, first of all, Pakistanis have already announced, the Pakistani military have announced that they've launched airstrikes against alleged border region strongholds, whatever that means. Is this just the beginning of an even further stepped up offensive?
Yes, I think it is. I think airstrikes are, of course, the pretext for what the terrorists did, for their atrocities. They said they're killing our people, so we're going to show them what it's like. But in fact, no army and no intelligence service and no government could let this insult, this horrific tragedy, this kind of almost unspeakable brutality pass without a feeling of not just getting at the terrorists, but the general clamour for vengeance. There is a kind of concept, you know, you killed our children, now we'll show you what can happen to you. And I think there's an element of that coming, which of course will probably escalate the thing further. There is also perhaps a way of drawing the squabbling politicians together, because they've all been too frightened to confront the real menace, which is Islamist extremism that has got a grip on society and a grip on many towns. I mean, Karachi is almost an ungoable town at the moment, a no-go area. And I think this will actually pull the establishment together in a determination finally to try to do something.
But as far as it's possible to tell, and I'll ask you, Jeffrey, is there actually a serious military solution to this? Because horrendous though this event is, Peshawar, well, and specifically the areas around it, the Northwest Frontier Province, it's always been ungovernable. It's rarely at all, if ever, fallen under the remit of any central government. I mean, I can't claim to be an old Pakistan hand, but I was in Peshawar in 1998 at a relatively peaceful and calm time. And even then, if I wanted to leave the city limits, that was impossible, or at least extremely ill-advised, without an armed escort. And that was in 1998 when things were calmer.
Let me say first, I want to answer that, but you know, in the news stories that come at us each day, so much, we see so much violence, so much that is just bad, and yet it passes by. This is one of those stories that just it makes me want to weep when I look at the images of the blood in that school. It is so horrific, and when you talk about the vengeance, I mean, you can understand it. I mean, I don't believe in revenge, but to answer your question, I was in Pakistan covering Daniel Pearl in 2002, the horrific beheading of Daniel Pearl. There is a long and dishonorable tradition of this kind of extremism in that country, and I think one of the things that I learned during that period is that the country is in many ways ungovernable. It is in many ways, although no diplomat would say it publicly, a failed state. They just don't control their borders. And when you see the prime minister today saying that, you know, we're going to work together, we're going to crush this, I heard that so many times. And I just they don't have the power. They don't have the discipline. They don't have the resources. They don't have the expertise. It's deeply sad. It's a huge country with huge potential. And yet it is fundamentally broken, and it is not capable. And I think the reason you see the rise of the Islamic extremists, I don't think there's any question, is because there is a power vacuum, and there is no central mechanism to contain it and to deliver to people, by the way, a better quality of life so that young people don't drift in that direction.
Michael, you mentioned there the statement that the Pakistani Taliban issued, saying, and that was pretty, you weren't paraphrasing them by that much. That was pretty much what they said. You kill our kids, we'll kill ours. But what I still don't understand, leaving aside the fairly obvious moral horror of the whole thing, does this make any logical, rational, strategic sense from the Pakistani Taliban's point of view? However ruthless, you know, unpleasant and ghastly though it is, they clearly made a conscious, deliberate decision to sacrifice 9 of their own men in order to mount this outrage. They must have thought that from their own perspective, some good would come of this.
Well, some advantage. It depends how you define good. But of course, they have this extraordinarily zealous, narrow view of religious extremism. And what they're probably looking for is a complete showdown. They're looking for a sort of Armageddon. They're looking for a chance, first of all, to have a real crack at the Shia minority in Pakistan, who are subject almost every day to unspeakable attacks. There are also clan rivalries going on all the time. There is a kind of social structure that, as Jeff said, is already broken. And I think that they're trying to take advantage of that. I was in Pakistan in May with the Archbishop of Canterbury, and when he was meeting bishops of the very, very small minority of embattled Christians in Pakistan, that very afternoon as he was meeting the bishops, only 10 streets away, a woman was being stoned to death by her father and her brother for daring to marry someone out of love and not from family honour. And as long as these perverted ideas of family honour are dominant and are impossible for civil authority to resist, then it's going to be very difficult to galvanise any sense of resistance to the extremist message, which is, in fact, given a free rein.
It is probably stating the obvious that this is a horrific and just unfathomable miscalculation by the Pakistani Taliban. But to give you a sense of just how outrageous, I don't know how much you've read about this, but there was a comment from the Taliban in Afghanistan condemning this, saying it's anti-Islam. Yeah. I mean, you kind of want to chuckle, but it's not funny.
Well, indeed, it is the bleakest of comedy. When the Afghanistan Taliban think you've overdone it, it's possibly time to take a bit of a look at yourself. But isn't that relationship, you know, there's still a kinship there. Isn't it likely, and this is a final thought on this one, Jeffrey, that there will regrettably and unfortunately be more of this kind of thing as the foreign forces leave Afghanistan, and we see an inversion of that dynamic which we've got used to over the last 12 years, where basically Pakistan has been the subs bench for the war in Afghanistan. It's about to become vice versa, isn't it?
And I think Iraq can sort of fit into all of that. I think we've got these just, you know, staying slightly, if you think of a drowning man just gasping for air, you know, these failed states trying to stay, you know, keep breathing and keep operating. Yeah, I mean, it is not a happy picture you're painting there.
Well, on that delightful thought, we will take a short break. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Miller, along with Jeffrey Kaufman and Michael Binion. When we return, we'll be asking whether it's yet time to start buying Russian wheelbarrow futures.
It's the art of publishing with skates on. Here it comes, Monocle Alpino. Here's what some of our wrapped up for the Elements editors have for you this winter.
In the affairs section, we take to the slopes with a Swiss scientist trying to predict when avalanches strike.
In the business section, we visit Slovenia to see how one ski company has been making its precious pieces since 1945.
In culture, we head to the Arctic Circle to find out how Norwegians do music festivals. Needless to say, they do them cooler than most.
Monocle Alpino is on newsstands now. For more information and Monocle subscriptions, head to monocle.com.
Finally tonight, to Russia, whose embattled, if not beleaguered, currency has today experienced what is known in financial circles as a dead cat bounce, according to the theory that even the proverbial expired feline will bounce if dropped from a sufficient height. Despite recovering 10% against the dollar today, up at one point at 17%, which is actually really one of the ruble's best days ever, it's still a shadow of the figure it cut prior to the Ukraine crisis. Michael, first of all, I realise I'm about to ask you to predict the future of the Russian economy, but is the worst over? Have they turned this round?
No, I wouldn't say the worst is over. I think the worst in terms of confidence collapse is possibly over. There's now going to be a whole series of political measures to try to show Russians that the government is dealing with it, or that Putin is dealing with it. I think what he'll do is he'll sack his hapless prime minister straight away, Medvedev, who's a bit of a cipher anyway. He will reshuffle the cabinet. He will possibly bring in some wise heads. He'll knock a few heads together in the economics ministry, and then he'll take a series of fairly spectacular steps to try to show that they're recovering confidence, because it's confidence at issue now. The long-term future is not good at all. Reliance on fossil fuels is 70% of their exports. There's nothing they can do about that. Ukraine, that's accounting for half of the mess. He will have to do some kind of deal. He won't do it under pressure or being seen to do it at the West's bidding. But there will be momentum inside Russia to really nail down some kind of deal with Ukraine.
That confidence thing, Jeffrey, it's always the thing, of course. There are stories of Russians queuing to buy some imported products while they still can, especially IKEA, who are, I think, either have or about to put their prices up. Apple are either readjusting their prices or stopped selling them entirely. Yeah. These straws in the wind, though, at what point do the Russian people stop buying Putin's line that this is all the fault of spectators, the West, America, sanctions, etc.?
This is why covering politics is even when you think, oh gosh, you know, this it can be so dull, and then moments like this happen, you realize this is why it's so interesting. Because, as Michael just said, Putin can't control certain external factors. And on one hand, he probably, the sanctions he might have been able to withstand for some time. A drop in oil without the sanctions he might have been able to withstand. But the two together, it's a toxic stew that he can't, he is really in a bind now. And your point, your question is right on point. At what point do all these people who tolerate him or give him their loyalty stand up and say, excuse me, but you know, you're making a mess of our country. You know, your aspirations for greater Russia, how about Russia as a reasonable Russia? And I don't think this is over for him. I think there's no sign that fossil fuel prices are going to go up. That is catastrophic for him. Foreign exchange is options are limited. And how much can the Russian central bank keep selling off currencies to try to maintain the ruble?
Well, for a while, because Russia, and I looked these things up to the extent that I understand these things, but that Russia does have a $200 billion trade surplus. It has $400 billion in foreign reserves. Is Putin in, Michael, do you think, is he possibly in a less rickety position than it might look?
Yes, I think for a number of reasons. First of all, that figure that you quoted, the rainy day fund, which they quite sensibly built up when things were going pretty well and when oil was selling for a high price, and they put it aside, thanks to the wise advice of the guy Kudrin, who they may now bring back, the foreign minister who was sacked about a year ago, but actually is the brains behind any economic recovery if there's going to be one. That can bail them along for maybe a year or so. The other thing is that a lot of Russians really do agree with Putin. Certainly over Ukraine they do. They also believe that the West has got it in for them. And however you spin it, they feel that Putin had no option but to resist what they thought was enlargement by NATO trying to strangle Russia. They really do see it that way, a lot of them. They are very angry about corruption, and they do blame Putin for not dealing with that. They also blame him for enriching himself. But I think he's quite adroit at times in, springing surprises. And he's quite nimble, and I think he may spring one or two political surprises. After all, when you've got a 70% rating still in popularity. It would take a lot to undercut that.
It's hard, though, when you outlaw or ban or imprison most of your opposition to have other people to have much popularity.
That is the cunning maneuver, yes, to say you rule out all other available options. We will have to leave it there, unfortunately. Michael Binion and Jeffrey Kaufman, thank you both very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokiost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Lots coming up in the second half of today's edition of Midori House. We'll be discussing the state of the Australian film industry, reviewing the new theatre openings with critic Matt Wolfe. And we'll speak to our woman in Brussels. But ahead of all that, Jonathan Wheatley has the headlines.
Thank you very much. The United States will restore full diplomatic relations with Cuba more than 50 years after they were severed, the US President Barack Obama has said, just hours after Havana announced it had released a US aid worker who'd been jailed for 5 years in Cuba. Alan Gross was released on humanitarian grounds. Thousands gathered today in Pakistan's largest city, Karachi, and held a candlelit vigil for the children and teachers killed in Tuesday's school attack in Peshawar. The Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif has lifted a moratorium on the death penalty a day after Taliban gunmen attacked a school, killing 132 students and 9 teachers. More than 230 bodies of people believed to have been killed by Islamic State militants have been found in a mass grave in Syria's eastern Deir al-Zor province. And the president of Sierra Leone has announced a ban on parties and other festivities over the Christmas and New Year holidays as the country tries to halt the spread of the Ebola virus. And that's latest news on Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.
And welcome back to Midori House live on Monocle 24. It is 21:32 in Moscow, 18:32 here in London, 16:32 in Rio de Janeiro. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. We're joined now by our correspondent in Brussels, Charlotte McDonald-Gibson. Charlotte, welcome to the show. In a day of, you know, obviously fairly momentous diplomatic manoeuvres, the European Parliament's vote in favour of recognising Palestine may get drowned out somewhat, but is it significant? Will it make a difference to anything?
Well, whether it will make a difference to anything, well, that remains to be seen. And it's significant in a symbolic way. I think it's significant because it's part of a broader wave of what's happening across Europe. I mean, we've had these votes in the parliaments in France, in the UK, in Spain, in Ireland, all about recognising the Palestinian state. So I think the decision at the European Parliament today was part of this frustration, this real growing frustration in Europe at the peace process and how it stalled and the settlements that Israel continues to build. And we get stronger and stronger statements, not just from the Parliament, but from the European Commission as well, speaking out against the settlement. So it sends a signal, I think, to Israel, and certainly Israel hasn't reacted particularly happily either to that development or the other development today, which was the European Union court removing Hamas from a list of terrorist organisations. So a couple of developments at the EU level today here.
Yeah, neither of which are going to play terribly well in Washington either. I did want to ask about that European Court of Justice manoeuvre. What is the rationale underpinning that? Because by most reasonable judgments, if Hamas isn't a terrorist organisation, it's kind of hard to know what one is.
Yes, exactly. It wasn't a political decision, and that's what everyone's been at pains to say today, the British government spokesperson, the EU spokesperson, they're saying this decision by the EU court, it didn't reflect a change in EU policy. It was purely procedural. So basically what the court said was when this decision was made back in 2001, it was based on media reports on the internet rather than factual analysis. And that is why it's now been overturned. But the EU does have 3 months to appeal. So I think they're going to do that. They signaled today that they were going to try to find a way to address this. And they've got these 3 months. And so there is a chance for this to be turned around again.
Okay, well, the European Commission presented a new work programme. They are, of course, caught in that bind between Britain, which wants the EU to rather cut back on regulation, and environmental groups, which are, of course, rather in favour of it. What have they come up with?
Yes, well, this is a problem. Like Frans Timmermans, he's the new EU Commissioner in charge of better regulation. It's a new post in the European Commission, which is created because of this sort of backlash against EU red tape, too much regulation. So, yeah, in his work programme, when he presented it yesterday, he proposed scrapping around 80 of 450 pieces of outstanding legislation, which are currently in the process of being debated by the member states, the parliament, the council. So he tried to strike them off and say, they're not going anywhere, let's not continue with this. This is a waste of our time. But yes, it's evidence that you can't please everybody all of the time, because the environmental groups were absolutely outraged that two of these pieces of legislation were what they saw as crucial environmental legislation, one dealing with air quality and another with waste disposal. So they automatically spoke out against this. And today we have the EU environment ministers who are meeting in Brussels today. They also were not very happy about it.
I mean, are you getting the sense that possibly counterintuitively the UK's vague talk about conducting a referendum on membership in 2017 is actually giving it a bit more clout within the EU as people sort of try to placate Britain so it doesn't push off?
Yeah, absolutely. We're getting this language not just from the Commission, but also from the European Council. The European Council, new European Council President Donald Tusk, he said similar things, that keeping Britain in the EU is crucial. It's good for the economy. It's good for the bloc's clout on the world stage. So countries do want Britain to stay in the EU, and this is the reason, one of the many reasons, why we're getting these proposals like the ones we had from Frans Timmermans yesterday. And I have to say, out of all the countries, Britain was the only one to really come out with a very positive statement, with David Lidington, the UK's Europe minister, saying quite clearly that they welcome these plans to scrap some costly draft laws. So there was one person happy with what happened yesterday.
And finally, we need to talk about the EU Leaders Summit, which begins tomorrow. It will be Donald Tusk's first summit as head of the European Council. What can we look forward to?
Well, the topic on the agenda, the main topic, is this Jean-Claude Juncker's new investment plan, which is something like 300 billion euros, which he hopes to kickstart growth in Europe. So that's officially on the agenda, although you never quite know what's going to happen. Obviously, at the last European Council summit, we had the explosion of the arguments about Britain's unexpected payments to the European Commission. So that turned out to be quite a colourful summit. And you never know, that could come up again over the next couple of days, or it could just be a lot of leaders agreeing for once about the investment plan, which seems to be the case. But what will be really interesting, I think, as well, is to watch Donald Tusk's leadership style. Like you said, it's his first European Council summit. He's a well-known face in Brussels. He was Poland's Prime Minister for 7 years, so he's attended plenty of these participants. So it'll be interesting to see how he fares as a chair, really, of this meeting.
Charlotte MacDonald-Gibson in Brussels, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Up next, we'll take a look at the Australian film industry, currently doing perfectly well, thanks, on the reviews pages, but rather struggling at the box office.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly audio guide to the world's best business minds. From industry giants and family outfits to the one-man bands and clever upstarts.
We saw all this immense amount of frustration by young people finding their first jobs, their second jobs, internships. And we said that's ridiculous, that in this day and age, with all the technology we have, we can't solve that.
Tune in at 1900 hours London time every Wednesday to hear insider tips, big challenges, and sparks of insight. We take an hour-long tour of the worlds of fashion to food, timepieces to tech, and hear the founding stories of some of the smartest names around.
I remember saying, deliver beer in New York City. I can hardly afford my car insurance, so I'm going to insure a truck.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, in association with Pictet.
Welcome back to Midori House, coming up for 1840 here in London.
I want to report someone stalking me and my child.
You can't get rid of the Babadook.
You can bring me the boy.
From The Babadook, much acclaimed Australian cinematic hit of 2014. Now, if you've made it to page 152 of the first edition of The Forecast, the latest publication from Monocle on a newsstand near you now, you'll be aware that a thriving new outpost of Australia's film industry is flourishing in Adelaide, a city often neglected in favour of its bigger and or brasher cousins on the east and west coasts. But it has been a mixed year for Australian film, though the country still produces a steady stream of critical successes, The Babadook not least among them. Home audiences are not turning up. As of October 2014, Australian films had accounted for just 2.28% of box office takings nationally. Well, joining me now to figure out why this might be the case are two Australian Monocle staffers. That makes three of us. Our Madrid correspondent, Liam Aldous, and Nolan Giles, our man in Brisbane. Hello, both. Nolan, first of all, that it does strike me as an astonishing figure that just 2.2% of the box office take in Australia is Australian films. We're still making great films in Australia. Why aren't Australians going to see them?
Yeah, it's definitely not the quality of the films that Australia's producing. It obviously comes down to the audience and what they're after and what they're interested in. And for example, The Babadook, which you were just playing there, that was a massively successful film overseas. In Britain, I think it took more in the first weekend at the box office than it actually did in the whole of its run in Australia. So, it's definitely not the quality of the films, it's the audience. And I appreciate Australian films, and I know there's a lot of people out there, but perhaps it's the cinemas and the networks sort of not getting behind Australian films enough and pushing them enough.
Well, this is a suggestion people have made, and I'll put this to you, Liam, that it's not so much that people have given up on films, they've given up on the cinema.
Do you think, though, it's actually a problem of the fact that Australia isn't a very big country, we don't have big audiences, and for a film
that's,
to be...
That's a problem with artists of all sorts, though. It's a problem for musicians, for authors, and it does sound like a counterintuitive thing to say about Australia, that it's a small country.
Well, yeah, I mean, population-wise, of course, for
it takes up a lot
fans
of,
out there.
It takes up a lot of space, but it's not a big country.
But what I'm trying to say is that for a film to be massively successful, it has to appeal to all kinds of audiences. So a Babadook film, a horror film, obviously isn't going to attract every type of audience, because a lot of people just don't go to see horror films. So the fact that it was more successful in the UK, it's even getting a release in Spain, I saw, in 2 weeks. So it's going international, probably based on its...
Where it will, of course, be known as El Babadook.
El Babadook or La Babadook, we don't know. I don't know if it's feminine or masculine. But I think it is a problem. That's definitely a problem. But, the films... this year that came out in Australia were actually quite varied. Usually we make very depressing films, and the conversation at the end of every year is, have we made uplifting films? Why are we just making films about crime families and drug addicts, which is often
we are keen on our drug addicts. We're keen on apocalypses as well.
One of those this year.
Yeah, the complete breakdown of societal order. That's a nice night out at the cinema for us. You mentioned there, Nolan, the fact that The Babadook had done really well released in the first week in England. There's now some suggestion that... or I should say Britain, because it still is. There is some suggestion that is the way forward for Australian movies. Release it overseas first, get all the good reviews, get people come to see it overseas, and then go back to the home audience and say they love this everywhere else.
Mm. I mean, that could be a successful formula. I mean, the industry is changing everywhere. It's not just in Australia where we're having problems with independent cinema. The industry is evolving quite rapidly. And that was one of the things I saw in Adelaide that was a positive thing to be coming from the Australian film industry, and that was the fact that they'd designed this studio there to support independent cinema, but also to be nimble and to be able to sort of take on TV when the cinema was slow, when the big films weren't coming in, to be able to adapt. And I think that's probably something that Australia has the opportunity to do, because it is a smaller industry. It's not like Hollywood, where, you know, they've been doing the same thing a certain way for a very long time. In Australia, perhaps the fact that we do have an independent, a small independent scene, it could work in our favour. Obviously, this year it didn't. But what's to say, I mean, like we were just talking about before, the quality is there and we have the names. And I think that might be another problem for Australia, the fact that we have these big superstars out there in the world that sort of say, you know, Australian cinema is fantastic, but the resources back home in Australia aren't as fantastic as this immense talent.
On that note, you were reporting from Adelaide about these sort of, as you said, these small, nimble, independent films. Is the problem that we cannot compete with the blockbuster?
Well, I don't know, but I think, I mean, Australia always has that underdog status, and the films that have competed with the blockbusters in the past, things like Muriel's Wedding, Strictly Ballroom, they've been shot on tiny budgets. So what's to, I mean, there's nothing to say that can't continue to happen. The passion is there in Australia in the film industry. Would you agree?
Well, I just like to say that we've got Mad Max Fury Road coming out at the beginning of next year. We have a massive blockbuster, and I think it looks great.
Really?
I think it's George Miller. He's back, Andrew. Get excited.
I know, but what are we up to now? Mad Max 6?
I don't know, but this one, it's got Tom Hardy in it. Come on.
I'm struggling to summon enthusiasm for the... I mean, I'm old enough that I remember the first Mad Max.
Well, I'm not, but getting back to the cultural cringe factor, I think it's definitely a good strategy to release them overseas first, because Australians always recognise talent when it's been successful overseas. If you try to get a job in a certain career in Australia and you have a tough time, if you go overseas and are successful, come back, you have the red carpet laid out for you, and not just in the cinema world. So I think perhaps that is a good strategy.
It's a nice idea, Liam. Not reflected in my book sales as of my last royalty statement. Do you think, though, Nolan, that there still is a... global culture has become increasingly homogenised. Mm-hmm. This is not an original observation. Is there still an Australian cinematic vernacular? Is there still something to our films you don't see in anybody else's?
I think there is. I mean, the sort of Australian films that I really enjoy are those films that are kind of, they deal with serious issues, but they're, I guess, injected with that dry Australian humour. And I mean, that was mildly apparent in The Rover. I mean, it wasn't that funny, but it was pretty bleak. But I think there definitely is a style, an Australian cinema style, and I mean, what would you say, Liam?
Did you see anyone here see Tracks, the amazing film, but
based on the Robin Davidson book?
Yeah,
I have not yet seen the
film.
It's
a beautiful film. I'm surprised it only made $2.44 million in Australia, which is actually not that bad. But it was critically acclaimed overseas, and it has all the Australian ingredients. It's got the wildlife, the outback, and a beautiful epic Australian tale. So I think there are definitely good stories being made, but they have to appeal to overseas audiences to be successful, and also be successful at home. So it's definitely tough for Australian films, but it seems like we have this conversation at the end of every year about the Australian film industry is in the doldrums. I just feel like if there's one big hit, then everyone's positive. Mm-hmm. If there's some mild successes, then everyone's quite pessimistic.
Liam Aldous and Nolan Giles, thank you both very much. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. '48 here in London. This is Midori House on Monocle 24. BlackBerry launched its new smartphone today at events in New York, Frankfurt and Singapore. The new phone, BlackBerry Classic, let's hope it does better than Coca-Cola. Actually, no, it was New Coke, wasn't it? This riff is going nowhere. New Coke was the problem. Coca-Cola Classic was the one that brought it all back. Well, let's hope it has that effect for them. Anyway, it's the company's second smartphone launched this autumn, and it's aimed at those users who appreciate the physical keyboard, which was once BlackBerry's trademark. Monocle's tech correspondent David Phelan showcased the new phone to our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé.
Yeah, I think it's very nice. It's called the BlackBerry Classic, and if you've ever used a BlackBerry Bold, it's immediately familiar. They've said they want to style it to look like that because that's been such a successful phone for them. And this looks very similar. It has their newer software on it, and obviously it's a lot faster. But the key thing that I think BlackBerry fans will really like is it brings back what's called the BlackBerry Belt, the physical buttons, including the trackpad, that make it much easier to use than an all-touch display, which is what they've used recently.
Mm. I want to come back to the keyboard in a moment, but the touch screen and the fact that most manufacturers are in that territory now, is that purely a cost issue? Because once you've got moving parts, it just becomes more expensive. And so, no matter how you tool up your factory, of course, it means potentially more things can go wrong as well, because you still hear all of these complaints from the consumer that, I don't like to type as long because I don't have a keyboard, etc.
Sure.
And yet BlackBerry has found this territory. Yes, a couple of other manufacturers have keyboards, but this is still their domain. Why have we ended up in this place where touchscreens are still inferior, and yet they dominate the market? Big question.
I think cost is part of it. I think it's versatility, that if you've got a touchscreen, it can have a UK keyboard, or it can have a Ukrainian or a Cyrillic keyboard. Just one swipe of the finger gives you a whole new screen, a whole new whatever you want on it. But also, I think the currency now is apps. Everyone uses Android or iOS or Windows Phone apps. And if you want the greatest compatibility, you want a screen that has the capability to show it.
Mm. And in this case as well, they've done something quite interesting, because there was a lot of rumors very early on that they would be getting into bed with another operating system, potentially. At least it had a world of apps, and they've managed to do this, at least up to a point.
Yeah, absolutely. They've done it very cleverly. Android, obviously, is the dominant system, but it's known as the Wild West. There are apps that just don't work, or they don't work with every phone, or they just collapse. What they've done is they've gone to Amazon, who have a version of Android on their phone, but they test every app very carefully before they allow it onto the system, so they are much more secure. It's a smaller number, but it's still more than 250,000 apps, so it's a lot. And I think BlackBerry have now worked out a way to test each app before they let you use other Android apps as well. So suddenly, the big currency that you need big numbers in, suddenly BlackBerry have got.
Mm. And just before we go, we've been hearing about this date, or at least people who are BlackBerry users. I'm one. I've been sort of wondering when this phone's been coming out. So of course you go and search for it. But there's not a lot of marketing around this. The companies to spend a lot of money. Of course, we see the likes of Apple and Samsung, of course, spending fortunes around their devices. Do you think that they've just said, people who like the device, they're going to go out and find the new one, and that's actually the new world where they are in terms of a business plan? They're not expecting meteoric growth, or do you think that they probably should be spending a little bit of money, even to make the existing consumers feel like they're still part of an interesting, viable world?
Absolutely. They've got to make the fans feel loved. I think you may see a difference this time. I think John Chen, the new CEO, has absolutely been backing the Classic, and it may be that he's going to go for bigger marketing. But certainly, you're right, everyone who's got a BlackBerry has known this was coming and has been waiting for it.
That was Monocle's tech correspondent, David Phelan, speaking to our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And as we near the end of today's show, it's time for our daily arts review. Today we're talking theatre, and we're joined once again by Matt Wolfe, critic with the International New York Times. First of all, we were going to compare and contrast a couple of musicals. Yeah. Now, I'm as we've probably discussed before, I'm kind of a tough sell on musicals because, all other things being considered, right. I would frankly rather bang nails into the roof of my mouth. So we have to talk about City of Angels and a Revival of Cats.
Okay, and we're keeping the nails out of it for the moment.
Okay.
Well, they're an interesting study in compare and contrast, because one, City of Angels is a show that is much beloved by critics, not always by audiences. The other one, Cats, of course, is an Andrew Lloyd Webber phenomenon that sort of sparked the global British musical explosion. They're both being revived contemporaneously in London. Cats in a huge, gaudy production starring Nicole Scherzinger at one of London's largest theatres. City of Angels in a small, bespoke Bijou production at one of London's smallest theatres, the Donmar. Guess which one I liked best?
I am sensing, Matt.
Yes.
a bias towards one of these productions. So Cats, obviously, you loved it, right?
It is what it is. What's interesting to see it now, 33 years after the original production, is that it's essentially a music hall. It's a lot of sketches linked by the fact that they're all based on a T.S. Eliot source, but that's kind of it. With this amazing John Napier set, which is a study in detritus on an epic scale, pushed way past the proscenium arch, and lots of Andrew Lloyd Webber anthems that you go out humming because they've been repeated so many times. City of Angels is something entirely different. It's incredibly literate, funny, sardonic. It's got sort of a movie within the show. It's about a writer and his creation. The writer is called Stein. The creation is called Stone. It's the best show that Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler never got around to writing. It's steeped in the language of 40s film noir. The characters are all archetypes of Bogart, Bacall, Veronica Lake. And if you really like that kind of thing, and if you have, you know, a passion for the glory days of Hollywood, it's great fun done with great style. It's a study in style, and it pulls it off beautifully.
Okay, we also wanted to talk about Hope, Jack Thorne's play at the Royal Court, London. This is some old school political drama, which we do have a clip of, which we will play first.
Allotments. I probably get more letters about allotments.
Speed bumps, I think, probably account for about 40% of my correspondence.
Council tax.
Citizens Advice Bureau.
One man asked me, in all sincerity, whether I could bring back the 8-track tape deck.
You do get people who think you are the government.
Some people who think you are God.
But most understand the limits of your job.
The truth is, it all matters. The achievements are small, but plentiful. Because it all matters.
We matter.
And we like the fact that we do.
So people on a stage talking very slowly and sonorously about speed bumps and allotments.
I feel nails coming back into your conversation here. This is a play that synoptically shouldn't work because it's about, you know, austerity, budget cuts, what's going on in the council, you know, back rooms of a fictional English town. How thrilling is that yawn? However, actually, it works very well because what Jack Thorne, the playwright, has realized is that the political, of course, is personal. And it's in the Royal Court tradition of plays that reflect how we live now. So although that might have sounded dry as sawdust, it actually has quite a lot of juice. And you get to know the characters caught up in a system which actually they are empowered to change. So you think when you go in, the title is going to be deeply ironic. There's no hope. Actually, the title means what it says. And how radical is that for the Royal Court?
Well, extremely. I mean, do you actually leave feeling vaguely uplifted?
You leave feeling vaguely uplifted as long as there are still these entities in the world known as people who might interact with other people and not just systems.
Okay, we also need to talk just finally and relatively briefly about the Almeida's new Merchant of Venice. I'm sure all the Merchant of Vegas jokes have been done because that is where they have recast it.
Yeah, I never thought, let's just put it this way, that I would use Shakespeare and Taylor Swift in the same sentence, which I now have just done. The reason is that Taylor Swift is one of the many artists who features in the soundscape of this production. It's Rupert Gould, who is kind of the Flash Harry of the English theater, yet again being very flashy, very revisionist, taking an admittedly problematic Shakespeare play, figuring out where is a contemporary place that is all about money, which is what the play is about. Voila, Las Vegas. Let's move Shylock, Portia, and everyone else to, you know, the land of casinos and gaming tycoons and see what happens. It's kind of interesting and kind of wearying, but if you think that Shakespeare is really dull and nail-worthy, this might actually make you revise your perspective. I
mean, basically and briefly, does it transcend the gimmick once you've got past the fact that, yes, it's the Merchant of Venice in Las Vegas? Does it still grab you?
I think it's hobbled by the gimmick to the extent that you sometimes worry that the actors spent more time on the accents than they did on the play. Having said that, it is fascinating for those who are not purists about their Shakespeare.
Matt Wolff, theatre critic with the International New York Times, thank you as ever for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's show. My thanks in particular to our earlier guests, Jeffrey Kaufman and Michael Binion. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Jonathan Bartlett. Our studio manager was Chad Chilvers. Up after the headlines, The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli. At 2200, The Daily with Emma Nelson and Romas Vusilis. This show returns at the same time tomorrow at 1800 London hours. But for this edition of Midori House, it's good night and thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.